everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to introduce our next guest, Graham Bodie. Graham is the Chief Learning Officer at the Listen First Project. He is also a professor at the University of Mississippi. He's a prolific researcher and writer, and he is a consultant who is dedicated to working with organizations and teaching people how to improve their listening and communication skills with the goal of developing better relationships. I'm excited for this conversation because Graham's research played a significant role in my learning and how I chose to write the book, The Disciplined Listening Method. Coming across his research was a turning point for me, and now I'm very happy to be able to share his ideas, his perspectives, his philosophy and research with all of you as well. So I'm really excited for all of the takeaways that we're going to have from this conversation, including, but not limited to, what does it mean to develop listening intelligence? What are the most common listening habits, and how can we develop ours and understand which ones are best to use in what situations? What are the two different types of meanings that we could be listening for in any conversation? How about what's it mean to be a barefoot listener? And even how can we improve how we give advice so it resonates and people are more likely to take action based on it? It's an incredible education-packed conversation. I'm really excited to share it with everybody. So thank you so much for being here and listening to this conversation today. As always, before we go further, want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. We have Humantel. If you haven't already, please head over to humantel.com. Check out their research, check out their writing, and then check out the online training that they offer for how to accurately understand what emotions people are likely feeling based on accurately identifying their facial expressions and changing in body language. Then once we identify that, we can do a much better job understanding where they're coming from, showing empathy, developing rapport, and connecting with others. And while you're there, when you choose to take the training, please enter the code INCOHESIVE25 for 25% off all of their online training that they offer on their website, humantel.com. Go check it out. Please also, for the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com and check out the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can see their educational calendar, all of their online and in-person events. You can look at all the networking, research, and membership benefits of joining the organization. And if you're interested, that's where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? What does it take to pass and maintain the designation? All of those answers for you and your team can be found at certifiedinterviewer.com for the International Association of Interviewers. And INCOHESIVE, please head over to INCOHESIVE.com to learn more about the programs that we teach for our client organizations around the globe when they reach out to us and ask us to work with their leadership team, their sales team, their HR team, and more to teach them the observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to obtain more of the truth, especially in sensitive situations, and encourage people to build stronger, more trusting relationships. Everything you'll need to find is over there at INCOHESIVE.com. Thank you so much for being here today. I truly appreciate it. So without further ado, I introduce to you Graham Bodie. Graham, it is so great to see you today. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
I know you have a lot going on, many different projects you're working on. So really what I would love to do to make the most of our time is dive right in and ask you, what do you believe from your expertise it means for people to have listening intelligence?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. It's a term that I wish I had coined, but I first was introduced to through my work with what's now called the Echo Listening Profile. Through that work, I've come to understand and also use and try and expand on this notion of listening intelligence. So listening intelligence is both a capacity of an individual as well as a property or a capacity of a group of people or an organization, if you will. And so at the individual level, it is we call it a kind of a three-part skill. It's first and foremost the ability to recognize in oneself those habits of listening that individual tends toward. What are the ways in which that individual tends to process information from others. So it's this self-awareness and eventually an ability to then shift those habits to enact different kinds of habits or different styles or preferences toward listening that meet the expectations of particular other people or particular situations or contexts. That's the second part. So the first part is awareness. The second part is shifting. And the third part is an ability to ascertain or figure out the listening habits of others so that you can speak more intelligently into how they prefer to process information. So at the individual level, it's this sort of ability to notice in oneself, shift oneself based on others, and then recognize in others what they tend to, how they tend to process so that we can have better conversations, interpersonal conversations. At the organizational level, it's the ability of an organization to mobilize what we call cognitive diversity of its workforce. And what that means is to recognize that not all employees or team members listen the same way, and that's okay, that we all bring our own set of habits and mannerisms and ways of processing information. And then if you view those different ways of processing information very similarly to the general cognitive diversity literature, what the literature suggests is that different ways of listening and recognizing those differences and putting together teams that have the different types of listening, the different strengths of the different ways in which you might listen, that those teams are more productive and efficient and effective than teams that would have all of the same type of listener for most, you know, for most of the kinds of problems or situations that teams are going to face. And so for organizations, listening intelligence is understanding the diversity of listening habits, styles, and preferences within a workforce, and being able to put together teams in strategic ways in order to, you know, have the most productive, efficient, effective teams possible. So when we talk about habits of listening, there's different models and, you know, out there. The one that I tend to rely on is based on the assumption that in any given message, there's two types of meaning. There's the content level meaning, or what the word, sort of the denotative or dictionary definitions of those words are. You add them all up together and you have the content meaning. And then there's a relational meaning, or the sort of how I see you and how you see me and how we both see our relationship. And that's imbued with all kinds of things like intimacy and power and so forth. So in a parent-child relationship, I can say, you know, clean your room. And I can say that in a way that indicates that the child has agency. Please clean your room, or, you know, can we figure out a way to get your room clean? Or what do you think about, you know, using some of your weekend in order to clean your room? You know, they're just, the content of that is still like dad wants a clean room. I might view my child as having agency, or I might say like, clean your room now. There's no negotiating here. Go now, clean your room. Right. And so there's that power where I'm viewing myself as the parent as having the power and the child not having a role in that decision. Right. So every message is imbued with both of those types of meaning, and we can listen to both the content and the relational aspects of messages with, you know, in different ways. So when we talk about the content level meaning, we typically talk about two habits of listening that are primarily relevant for content level meaning, which are analytical and conceptual. It's the degree to which you primarily focus on facts, figures, data, sort of objective aspects, or the degree to which you look at or listen to that message in terms of the bigger picture. Your brainstormer versus your, you know, kind of Googler, or, you know, the person that likes to get it right is the analytical listener, and the person that likes to think about possibilities is your conceptual listener. On the relational, listening to the relational meaning of messages, we typically talk about the habits that are called relationally oriented listening or connective listening reflective listening. So a connective listener tends to listen much more for emotions and the feelings behind the facts. They tend to also be co-opted by dynamic speakers, whereas reflective listeners tend to primarily be more inward focused and think about what does this mean for me and my goals. So it's a difference between externally focused listening, what does this information mean for others, and internally focused listening, what does this information mean for me? Those are the four habits that we chart out or that we document with the ECHO listening profile: connective, reflective, analytical, and conceptual. And they loosely map onto this idea that we can listen to both content and relational elements of speech in more or less sort of nuanced or particular ways. And so that's the way that I think about listening intelligence, both at the individual level as well as at the organizational level.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the differentiation between the individual and the organizational level. And I do want to pause and give a quick shout out to Allison O'Brien from ECHO Listening, who introduced us, and hopefully listeners say, wait a minute, haven't we heard that before? And they've listened to her conversation previously, but want to give them credit and say hello to her and thank her for the introduction as well. So certainly appreciate that. And as you were talking through the different habits, I believe that some people, probably most of us, default to listening to what's in it for me as opposed to what's in it for somebody else. I might not be phrasing that the right way, but we have our own goals, our own focuses. And it can be easier to default to that when we're listening as opposed to defaulting to what do other people need to experience in order for us to move forward in this relationship, dialogue, objective, whatever it may be. So as you're exploring these four habits, have you found techniques or methods to help people shift how they listen and maybe become more open to other people's needs or perspectives throughout conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, first of all, is the recognition of how you show up as a listener. So without knowing first and foremost how you actually show up, not how you want to be, but how you actually show up would be the first step. The second step is to reconsider the idea that we have about good listening. A lot of people want to ask, like, well, am I a good listener? Am I a bad listener? Is he a good listener? Is she a bad listener? And that's just the wrong question to ask. Rather, instead of asking, am I a good or a bad listener, are the habits of listening that I have, are my listening habits helping or hindering me in this situation? There certainly are some situations where we should be primarily listening for what's in it for me. There's other situations where we ought to be considering, what does this mean for others? There's some situations where we ought to be carefully sort of, PowerPoint 2 and PowerPoint 47 don't match. This number doesn't match that number. What you said earlier, where's your source? Can you point me to, and in other times we ought to be brainstorming, right? Which typically isn't at the end of the meeting when everybody's ready to make a decision, right? So these different ways of processing information, these different ways of listening, these different habits, preferences, styles of listening serve the purpose of being the type of listener that you should be, given your conversational partner, given your goals, given their goals, given different other aspects of that situation. So an intelligent listener, someone who has a high level of listening intelligence, will recognize they themselves have goals and that the other individual has goals, those goals can be classified both as primary goals, what is driving me into the situation, which tends to be your typical informing, entertaining, persuading, disciplining, these kinds of sort of primary or what we call push goals, the things that push us into the conversation in the first place. And also we have pull goals or secondary goals, things that constrain our behavior. When a student comes into my office and wants to change their grade, there's all kinds of strategies that they can enact. They could bribe me. They could begin crying and, you know, request a handkerchief. You know, they could do all sorts of things. But they're going to be constrained from doing just anything because they don't want to be seen as a student of X height. They want to be seen as competent, as able, as a good student, as all these sort of things, as somebody that is, you know, independent and all these things, right? And so those secondary goals, those relational goals, if you will, pull us from engaging in just any behavior when we're trying to seek and persuade someone. You know, so in your work, for instance, when you're, you know, critically questioning somebody, when you're, you know, interviewing somebody, or a healthcare provider that's, you know, trying to change a patient's behavior, get them to stop smoking or start exercising or eating healthy or take a statin or whatever, you can just, you know, you can demand it. If I want my kid to clean my room, you know, that cleaner room, that's going to go over like a lead balloon with my kids, right? Given their age and the way that we typically structure our household, right? So I've got to realize, what are my goals? What are their goals? What are all the different contextual factors that are limiting or constraining my behavior? And then engaging in the kind of listening to figure out what those goals are. And then once I can figure out what those goals are, then I can I can shift my speaking to speak into their primary ways of listening so that they hear the message in the way that helps me meet my goal and helps them meet their goal and creates, you know, more of this, you know, this kind of a, you know, win-win situation as a more of a myth than it is a reality. But if we, you know, for sake of argument, if we can create a situation where everyone feels good about the conversation, or at least no one really feels like, well, that was terrible on, you know, on my end. Then those are the kinds of conversations, those are the kinds of negotiations, those are the kinds of situations that we want to be able to foster with the kind of listening that is sort of that meets the demands of that particular situation, that particular person, that particular relationship.
It's a fantastic explanation. I think many people have heard the concept of like situational leadership, situational listening, which really is leadership in so many ways. But understanding what I want to achieve with these people in the context of this situation, what's the best approach that's likely going to create the proper connection to do that. And I love the differentiation between the primary goals and the secondary goals. And what am I necessarily trying to achieve? And, you know, what are the relational constraints that I have to do that? You mentioned the myth of the win-win. And I chuckle when you say that because I agree. But I feel like whenever I have like larger conversations with people about listening, I find that people make a lot of well-intentioned mistakes based on myths that they believe to be true. And maybe mistakes isn't the best way to say it, but suboptimal judgments or choices might be a better way to say it. From your expertise and your research, what are some of the more well-intentioned choices that people believe they're making for the right reason, but should probably stay away from because it's not helping them achieve those goals?
Yeah, I think, you know, probably in terms of listening in particular, first and foremost is that there is some universal way of being a quote unquote good active listener, right? You know, certain behaviors, of course, eye contact is important, at least in this culture for most people from a Western culture. But, you know, to say like you should always paraphrase or you should always ask an open-ended question or you should always do anything, you know, for that matter. There's no universal good listening, right? Again, listening is situational, contextual. Good listening is based on the situation. So ought you know, paraphrase? Yes. Well, how? Right? I mean, one of the problems with, you know, when you search Google and, you know, what is a good listener, you get these articles, and you know, so number one, shut up. You know, number two, eye contact. Number three, paraphrase. Number four, ask questions. I mean, the same thing, sort of regurgitated and, you know, spun for the particular, you know, whether it's Forbes or HBR or whatever. And it is true that, you know, questions are a good way to listen more and talk less. And it is true that feeding back to someone what they've said is oftentimes a good strategy. But, you know, parroting back to someone, you know, if you're a salesperson and someone comes in and they're looking for a new mattress and they say, my back is aching, and you say, so I understand your back is aching, they're like, yeah, like I literally just said that. Why are you telling me what I literally just said, right? They're not telling you that story so that you can repeat back to them the words that you use. They're telling you that story for a reason. And you, as a listener, have to figure out. And so if you treat everybody like a storyteller, one of the keys to effective listening that I teach when I go inside organizations is let the story be told. And the sort of, you know, treat everyone like a storyteller. What story are they trying to tell you? Why are they telling you that story? They're telling you that story because they're seeking empathy or validation. They're telling you that story because they have a pain point that they want you to try and figure out. They're telling you that story because they want help or advice, but they are too sort of, you know, reticent to ask for it, or they're too prideful to come out and seek that advice, right? And you launching into the advice, what we call bald on record, you know, just, oh, here's what you should do, boom, right, is generally not, you know, taken very well. And so there's some strategies to, you know, to put your advice into a larger context where people will actually uptake that advice and implement that advice, or at least consider implementing that advice. And so all that to say that one of the biggest myths is that there is, you know, five things that every good listener always does in all situations with all people at all times, right? Listening is not an inherited capacity. It's an acquired art, right? It's part art, part science. You are likely to do it well with some people in some circumstances and fall just completely miserably on your face in failure with other people in other situations. And so it's a lifelong, opportunity to tweak and hone and figure out and get better and learn different kinds of strategies, whether those strategies are formal, like appreciative inquiry or motivational interviewing, or unique to you and the other person, sort of because you have a certain kind of relationship and there is no name for it, but you know, this way of listening to this person in these circumstances tends to work, right? And so it's that lifelong exploration, both of the formal methods and models, and also sort of, you know, failing and learning from those failures and having that meta communication with your spouse or your kid or your coworker. Hey, that conversation we had yesterday was kind of awkward, and I'm just trying to figure out what I can do differently so that we don't, you know, and they're going to be like, oh, thank goodness, you know, he just acknowledged that, because I was thinking all day that it was awkward as well. And there's no blame. And, you know, it's just like trying to figure out how we can communicate together and how we can have a better relationship, whether it's working or personal or whatever the case might be.
And just how it gets back to self-awareness, the self-awareness to realize that if that was awkward, it probably wasn't just awkward for me. I didn't want it to be that way. How do I get better? Let me ask. So that circles back to the self-awareness piece that you mentioned before, as we all strive to develop this listening intelligence. And I couldn't agree more that it's so situationally based. There's no one right way. What are we trying to achieve? Who are we trying to achieve it with? You did mention in there that there are some strategies for being more successful, having people accepting or at least being open to our advice. I know this is a bit of a shorter conversation, so to whatever detail you're comfortable sharing or ideas you think might be best fit for this conversation, what are some of those strategies or approaches that are typically more successful if we do feel that it's important for someone to accept our advice in a given situation?
Yeah. So advice is tricky, right? Advice given at the right time in the right way can, you know, help that person, you know, sort out their problem or their issue. So generally speaking, giving and receiving advice is a threat to what we call faith or your public image. This goes back to some work in sociology by a group of scholars, Brown and Levinson, that goes back to, you know, some other people, some other philosophers and scholars. And basically they differentiate between positive faith and negative faith. And I always forget which one is which. But basically this notion that we want to be seen as capable people, you know, people being able to handle our own, issues, our own problems. And that's why we don't like to ask for advice, why it's uncomfortable asking for advice, and why when someone tries to give us advice, we're oftentimes resistant to that advice, and we don't want to take that advice. So the best advice is very much like the best form of persuasion, which is self-persuasion. If you get the person to advise themselves, right? And of course, I think I'm smart. And so if I come up with the solution, like, yeah, that's brilliant. So if you can ask questions and get people to kind of ascertain and figure out their issue or their problem, that it's better, right? To get them to say, well, maybe I haven't tried this or I haven't tried that. You can get there by first providing what we call highly person-centered emotional support. So particularly in situations where someone's coming to you stressed out, the first order of business is to validate that what they're feeling is acceptable. It's okay to be feeling stressed. It's okay to be feeling frustrated or angry or sad or whatever the feeling is. To put a label on the emotion, to allow them to sort of feel human, right? As Carl Rogers said, like we all have an innate need to be accepted. And that highly person-centered, that validating, that legitimizing type of emotional support can help people to feel human, can feel accepted. And then once people feel accepted, once they receive that high quality emotional support, the next move is called problem analysis. What's the problem? What's the issue? It could be easy, right? I got a bunch of parking tickets, or I didn't study, or my house is a mess, or whatever, right? There's a certain problem, and I've got to analyze that problem. Some problems are simple, and other problems are complex, right? So problem analysis step could be very short. Problem analysis step could be infinitely long because it's super complex. But whatever that is, you got to go through some sort of problem analysis, because the third step, the advice, has to be particular to the problem. So if someone, if a student comes in and it's like, I bombed Professor Jones's test, like, well, study next time. Maybe this person studied 14 hours, right? Maybe they've studied more for that test than they have for any other test than they've ever studied for, right? So it's not necessarily that they didn't study. It's something else, right? And so without proper analysis of the problem, you don't know what they've tried, number one. And or what the problem even is and what you ought to advise toward. And so if you can couch your advice, or better yet, get them to couch their own advice in proper problem analysis framed by highly person-centered or high-quality emotional support, that advice can be less face-threatening. It can allow them to feel competent, confident, able to handle their problems. And it can allow them to handle similar problems in the future without necessarily having to come to you with that problem. I don't know what show I was watching the other day, but the grandparent told the mom, if you do a good job as a parent, they don't need you anymore, right? And that's part of the paradox, I suppose, of being a parent, is that your children, what you're trying to do is you're trying to teach them in the ways of independence, all while sort of having this urge and this desire to be the one that helps them, sort out their problems. Similarly with a leader in an organization, if you train up your workforce in the proper ways, they're able to solve problems on their own without necessarily having to come to you with all the issues that they have. But giving advice, in a particular way, helping, leading them along a problem analysis path is what's going to both help you land your advice properly and or allow them to advise themselves toward the goals that they want to seek for that situation.
Thank you. And perhaps preferably help them advise themselves, because to your point, they're more likely to buy in at that point. And for me to even confess, it can be really hard, even if I'm thinking about it, to try to validate somebody's emotions first before getting into the problem-solving analysis or just cutting straight to the advice. Well, I'll do this. Or making the mistake of just telling people, oh, relax, calm down. Like, even just saying those things first feel logical and intuitive. Well, that will help them think, no, there's a good chance it's just going to piss them off even more. And now I'm creating more emotional hurdles to have to work through. And that's a mistake that I've been guilty of any number of times. So I do believe that concept of helping them manage the face, as you referred to it as, is super important, validating the emotions first. And I would love your thoughts on this. I am a big proponent of the fact that in many situations, if we're looking to move forward with another individual in any type of relationship, if we're discussing a topic that could be sensitive to some degree, that makes them vulnerable, feel vulnerable to some degree, the number one thing we need to do is help them save face in order to engage them in the conversation. And again, sometimes we try to do that in ways that backfire. Sometimes we do it in ways that are successful. But from your research, how important is the concept of helping people save face to navigate emotionally difficult conversations?
Oh, I mean, look, if you say something or don't say something that leads someone to believe that you think they are silly, stupid, overreacting, whatever, they're not opening up to you, right? They're not like, oh, Michael's the guy that I ought to open up to because he thinks I'm stupid, right? And so, yeah, you ought not say or do or not say or not do something that leads someone to believe that they are, dependent or otherwise not able to, deal with or solve their own issues. And, there's a rule, and I've learned this somewhere along the way that someone at some point called the 5% rule. And regardless of how egregious or stupid or crazy someone sounds, there's 5%-ish of what they've expressed that you can validate. Now, notice I didn't say agree with. Notice I didn't say change your worldview to align toward, but rather to validate. So something as simple as, given who you are, given your circumstances, given your life experiences, I can see how you view the situation in the way that you see it, even if I completely, I'm unable to do that. I mean, we have this really weird sense of this notion of empathy, that it is literally getting into someone else's shoes. And that's impossible, right? Like if we're literally talking about shoes, I'm not fitting into my wife's or my daughter's shoes. Like I literally cannot fit into them. Right. And even if I could, let's take their heels, for instance. Right. I would be right. I'm tripping all over the place. Right. I'm not used to that. And to say that I have to put their shoes on to experience life like them. Well, that's impossible. Right. I'll never know what it's like to be a woman, a female teenager, right? I'll never know what it is like to be someone other than in a skin color other than the skin color that I'm in, or other than the way I was raised, right? I don't know, right? Rather than thinking about, walking a mile in someone's shoes, which is kind of the saying, right, that we literally have to experience life as them or imagine what life would be like them, rather, why don't we take our shoes off and in that, sense, take our socks off. I call it barefoot listening, and just be with the person, be present with them, listening to them and opening our ears to how they express themselves, not to imagine the world like they would imagine, which actually can cause a lot of stress in you as a listener, but rather listen in a way that just appreciates that this person experiences life like they do. And even if it's completely different than the way I experienced, like, that's okay, right? It's okay that we have different worldviews, different experiences, different ways of interpreting the world. In fact, there's, just like fingerprints are not really, unique to the person, but for sake of argument, like every snowflake is unique. Every fingerprint, right, is unique. Very similarly, right, every worldview, every life experience, every person is unique in that way because their brain has been wired to hear and see things like they hear and see them. And it's likely not going to ever happen that they see things or hear things differently, right? If you remember the Laurel Yanny, right? You're always going to hear Laurel or Yanny. The dress, you're always going to either see the gold or the blue dress, right? It's just because our optical system, our auditory system have been wired from birth, and socialized onward to navigate the world in the ways that we navigate the world. And so it's really sort of putting down this notion that communication can ever be perfect, that miscommunication is a misnomer, right? That there's no such thing as perfect communication, that I don't, take the thoughts in my head and extract them and place them in a conduit that we call language and send them over to you, or put it in a needle and shoot you in the arm, and all of a sudden you have my exact thoughts, right? Communication is an imperfect way to get what's in my head out of my head somehow into your head. And it's never going to be, right, in a way that's a perfect translation. So there's always going to have to be some give and take. And so if we keep that in mind, that communication isn't perfect, that language isn't a conduit, it's more like a blueprint, and that there's always going to be differences, that the rooms are going to be, you know, slightly different or a little bit larger, a little bit smaller, the bathroom, the toilet's going to be on the accidentally on the other end, whatever, right? Those blueprints are a little bit different. If we can recognize that and work through those hiccups, and again, this takes, you know, in addition to listening intelligence, just general communicative intelligence, is understanding that people have different ways of seeing the world, and that's okay. And that actually, in a workforce, that can be to the advantage of the organization, to bring people into the organization that see things differently. One of the best definitions of consultant I've ever heard is someone who takes your own watch and tells you what time it is. You know, it's just somebody that can see things a little bit differently, you know, and put a little bit different, you know, perspective on a situation, on a problem, to see it from a little bit different angle so that it can be solved in a little bit different way.
Another fantastic description. For me, on the validation piece, one of the things that I found successful for me to tell people is just that's a valid perspective. Yep. And a lot of times, even if, you know, they're escalating, well, it's a valid perspective. I didn't expect to see that or to hear that. It makes me feel a little bit better. I can start calming the temperature in the room and moving on from there. I heard you mention staying present. And I feel like, kind of like the articles you mentioned before, like, here are the five things you need to do to listen. All the time I hear people say, well, you just need to be present. You just need to be present. You just need to be present. But if we asked any one of those individuals to describe to us what does it actually require to be present, the answer would probably be, well, you know, just be present. So from your research and your expertise, what do we need to do in order to work as hard as possible to stay present within our conversations as often as we can?
Yeah. So first of all, to address the, you know, question about validation, be careful, because if you say that's a valid point, someone can say, well, why do you think it's a valid point? Right. And so you got to be able to, like, not just say that as a throwaway in order to, you know, to win their influence, if you will, but to legitimately say, you know, from your perspective or given your concerns or given the way that you see things, you know, so when we're talking about whether it's, you know, someone's having debate about whether climate, you know, change exists or doesn't exist, or whether the election was stolen or whatever, like there's legitimate perspectives inside what we might call a conspiracy theory, fears, you know, the fact that other elections in the history of elections have been tampered with, you know, the fact that there are all kinds of, you know, things that did happen that add up to suspicions. Like, we can validate those things without necessarily saying, I agree with you that the election was stolen, for instance, but that sort of, like, you know, we are so sometimes unwilling to concede a point because it seems like we're agreeing with the totality of someone's worldview. And so we just double down, like, no, nothing you say has any merit. Like, well, I mean, you know, right? And give me a break, right? So be careful, figure out what it is that you can validate. And if you legitimately aren't able to validate, you know, someone, don't say that, but rather sort of genuinely say, I really want to understand how you see this, right? So can you help me unpack where this is coming from so you find something, right, to validate? So that, you know, that on the valid, just wanted to, you know, kind of throw that out there on the validation side. You know,
great in clarification. Terms of presence, thank you.
Yeah, in terms of presence, the other word, of course, is mindfulness, which gets thrown around a whole lot, you know, be mindful. And there's all kinds of models and ways in which we might think about mindfulness, you know, or presence. I think the first thing to recognize is that it's an impossibility to be 100% present 100% of the time, and to be okay with distracting thoughts or paying attention to things that may be tangential or peripheral, right, to the situation. There was a really interesting study that just came out this year in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. And the first study that they did was just to document how much people, you know, when they are, you know, really trying to listen and be present, how much of the time does their attention divert? And it was something on the order of like 25% of the time on average, our attention goes away before it comes back. The good news is that the person who's speaking can't recognize that. The bad news is that the person speaking can't recognize that, right? So my wife is really good at this. If she notices that that I or one of my kids are on their phone while she's trying to say something, so, I'll let you finish. So it's recognizing what are the things that tend to distract of your phone or your own internal thoughts. It's, you know, sort of, you know, acknowledging to the other person, like make the weirdness, the awkwardness of saying like, dude, I'm just totally spaced out. I don't know what you just asked me in this podcast that we're supposed to be, you know, we're talking about listening and I spaced out. I should be able to say, right, I don't really remember the exact question. Can you rephrase? And I should be okay with that. And it shouldn't be a stigma because it happens to all of us, even the best among us. We can't sustain 100% attention, 100%. There's a leaf blower going on out there. Every so often it gets a little bit louder and my attention goes a little bit more. The person next door to me in the office next door just got here. I heard, you know, the door, you know, so very, those momentary, right? My attention, if you're, you know, at a party and you're listening and you hear, or you think you hear your name, the cocktail party effect, right? Your attention gets diverted, right? So there's all kinds of distractions. External and internal distractions. So very much like listening intelligence and habits is like figuring out self-awareness. I've got an activity that I run people through when I consult and coach. It's called the listening barriers activity. And it just sort of like be present or be aware for the next 24 to 48 hours. Just write down anytime your attention is diverted or anytime you get bored in a conversation or anytime you start daydreaming, what's happening, right? What is it? Is it, and then do you see patterns in that? Is it a certain time of day? Is it, before or after your caffeine consumption? Is it, you know, what is it? And is it with a certain person? Is it about a certain topic, right? Is it because you've sat behind your computer? Is it only on Zoom? Is it also in person? Like all these kind of things, right? And then I've got a checklist of common barriers that people experience and we go through those and we say, what are your top three and what are you going to do? And then people have a listening goal. So if their primary barrier is judging, well, let's figure out how you can do less judging. If it's rehearsing, figure out what you're going to say before the person finishes, you know, what is that? I mean, interestingly, there's some, I think fMRI or EEG, I can't remember what they use, but they showed that the listener, their motor muscles, their speaking muscles amp up like almost a second before the speaker's finished speaking. So it's not, you know, so if you ever have this notion that like my main barrier is getting ready to speak, well, it's physiological, right? It's like, it's almost like inherently human to do this. And so it should be okay to say or acknowledge in a conversation, you know what, you lost me, I'm lost, I'm sorry, get us back on track. That ought to be okay. And we ought to normalize that a little bit more. So being present isn't, you know, 100% of the time, right, staying focused, but it is being able to recognize what are your barriers. So you can do some things before the conversation to minimize those barriers. During the conversation, you can recognize those barriers and figure out a way to overcome them. And then after the conversation, figuring out what you did that wasn't ideal or perfect, and be able to shift for next time to be able to. So it's those what we call meta communicative or meta listening strategies before, during, and after a conversation, and tweaking. And again, lifelong learning, figuring out how to be the best listener for that person in those kinds of situations going forward.
That was all fantastic. And I'd like to throw on, and I love your thoughts on this as well. When people do zone out on us, especially knowing that on average, the best of us are going to do it 25% of the time for any number of reasons, try to stop taking it personally.
Yeah.
I feel like I interact with way too many people who get angry when they feel like somebody is zoned out on them. Like, that's an indictment of how you feel about me, that you're not listening to me. When to everything you just illustrated, there could be physiological reasons. There could be other very real distractions, other things going on that took me away from you at that moment. It's not personal. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with you.
Yeah, it could be me. It could be you. It could be the dynamic, right? Or it could just be some external factor, time of day. I'm hungry. You know, I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. You know, for me, it's at some point, if I haven't exercised, all I think about. When can I go to the gym or get out for a run? Like, that's, you know, and it happened to me Sunday when my youngest had to spend the night, you know, somebody spend the night, and my oldest had a dance. And so, like, I was out at 11:30. Look, my bedtime's 8:30 if I can help it, right? And so, like, I'm driving kids, you know, to go spend the night while, and then the next morning I needed to be around. So when my youngest and her spend the night, person was over, that I could make breakfast, you know? And so I didn't go to the gym like I usually do on Sunday morning. And my wife was like, well, and after lunch, we wanted to clean out the office. So it was like 2:30. And I was just like, I gotta go, you know, cause we have the thing on at 6 o'clock. I really, like, I'm feeling antsy. So, you know what it is for you, and, or be able to rearrange your schedule. And sometimes that's impossible to be able to rearrange your schedule. But, you know, figure out a way to cope with or deal with it and acknowledge it. You know, right now, all I can think about is going to the gym. That's on me. I'm sorry. I don't know what to do about it because it's happening. And so is there some way, right, that we can, you know, assure me that in 30 minutes, I'm going to be able to do this better or the other?
Which circles back to self-awareness once again, such an important topic. For me, there's plenty of them, but it's hunger. When I start getting over hungry, forget it. I'm not listening. I'm not paying attention. I'm probably getting agitated. My wife carries around protein bars in her handbag, like, at all times. And there's times where she'll pick it up well before I do, where she won't even say anything. She'll just take out a Quest bar and hand it to me. I'm like, oh, I'll be quiet for the next 15 minutes. Yeah. And then after this, we can re-engage. You mentioned the barriers to listening, and the two that I believe I caught were the judgment and the rehearsal. Without getting too deep into what you do with your clients, are there some other common barriers that we typically run into that it can be helpful to become aware of?
Yeah. So comparing or bringing everything, you know, back to you, not just comparing, but trying to one up, like, oh, you should hear about what happened. You know, somebody telling you about their day, like, oh, you think that's bad? Let me tell you about my day. You know, regardless of what happened, almost regardless of what happens in my seventh grader's, you know, day at school, chances are something happened to me that was 100 times worse in the grand scheme of things, objectively speaking. But to her, whatever did happen was a big deal, right? Otherwise, why is she telling me? We go back to let the story be told, and linking that up with, you know, telling someone it's not a big deal or to relax. Like, if they thought it wasn't a big deal, they would not be telling you that story, right? So clearly they think it's, you know, conversations operate on what's called the cooperative principle. And generally speaking, we are, and we expect other people are being cooperative. What does that mean? That they're telling us the information that they think is relevant. They're telling us enough information that we should be informed, and they're not telling us information that is irrelevant, right? So if you ever find yourself going, that's totally irrelevant, or not to them, there's some reason they're telling you that. There's some reason they made that connection, and it may not be clear to you or anybody else in the conversation other than them. I mean, my wife and I were having a conversation yesterday about our schedule, and we were talking about this week, who's going to pick up the kids when and who's going to work when, because we both work full time. And at some point I switched the conversation to the semester, and then I switched back to the week, and I knew that I was making the switch, but she still thought I was talking about the semester. And she said something, I was like, wait a minute, why is she mad right now? Oh, she thinks I'm asking her to only work until 3 o'clock every single day for the rest of the semester. It's like, no, time out. That's not, I'm sorry. I switched back, right, to this part of the conversation. So right? The barriers are sort of assuming that everybody's on the same page, or assuming that I'm listening to paragraph two on page 53 when I'm really, when we're back on page 35, or we're fast forwarding to page, 144. Comparing, judging, mind reading, assuming that you know what the person is thinking or feeling without actually asking for them. Those are some of the more common ones that people report kind of stumbling over.
A great list, and all, I would assume, quite common for most of us multiple times a day. When you and I spoke previously, we had a brief conversation, and the topic of nonverbal behavior came up in this, the concept of reading body language. And when I heard you mention assumptions, my thoughts bounce back to that, because I feel like for many people, they have either misinformed or unfortunate assumptions of what body language may or may not mean in any given situation, while completely ignoring context or other factors. From a lot of the people that I asked this question to have more of an investigative background. So I'm very interested in your thoughts on this, just from a general listening, communication, that concept of being cooperative, helping each other. Mm-hmm. What are some of the most unhealthy myths in nonverbal communication that you see negatively impacting conversations?
93% of communication is nonverbal. That's the number one myth. Yeah. So this comes from a series of studies done back in published in 1967 by Morabian. And even he says that's a terrible interpretation of those studies. I can dig up what I wrote about this for a newsletter several years ago, if you want to include it in your show notes. But basically, he came up with this equation, and it was like 55 plus 13 plus whatever equals 93. And it was based on the degree to which people were assigning particular emotions to a series of either visual images, like whether this person's happy or sad or whatever, and voice that was matched or mismatched. So someone said, "I'm happy," and they sounded happy, or they said, "I'm happy," and they sounded mad or whatever, right? And so based on these two studies, which were very limited in terms of their methodology, he said that up to 93% of the emotional content in communication can be or could be attributed to the face, the voice, right, nonverbal component. And what you see now plastered all over the internet is 93% of communication is nonverbal. And if you believe that, then go to your favorite streaming service, pick out the most recent comedy special, push play, and then hit mute. You're not laughing, right? And you're not laughing because you can't hear what they're saying, right? And so in some situations, nonverbals are 100% of the meeting, right? If I were to flip you off right now, I don't have to say anything, right? And that is could be a jest, or it could be a literal, indication of how frustrated I am at your driving or whatever, right? And so when we teach through the lens of echo, when we teach people to try and recognize the listening habits of others, we say that certain listening habits tend to have a nonverbal profile that looks like this. So connective listeners tend to be much more expressive, nodding their head, sort of smiling, being very emotional with their face, sort of, leaning in, these kind of things. Reflective listeners tend to be more stoic. Analytical listeners tend to look like curious, conceptual listeners tend to be more fidgety and like stand up in meetings and walk around and things like that. And these are tendencies. And so what we say is that we want to treat nonverbal behaviors as hypotheses that we test. Right. Very much like when someone tells us something and it sounds like they're frustrated, but they haven't said, "I am frustrated," that we can treat the indications of frustration as a hypothesis to test. Is that the emotion underlying their behavior, or is it some other emotion that they haven't recognized? So You know, definitely, whether it's, you know, detecting lies, which you know, is not my area of expertise, but I know you've dabbled in that both professionally and you know the literature and you've met Tim Levine as well, that in that literature or in the literature on how someone really feels about us or is really feeling in the moment, are they happy, sad, frustrated, or whatever, that nonverbals are, there's not a perfect one-to-one correspondence between what I'm feeling or thinking and the way my body does things, right? And so if I cross my arms, it could be that I'm, you know, closed off or I'm cold or that's how I stand because it's comfortable or whatever the, or I'm, you know, because putting my hands down by my side or in my pockets or whatever is weird or can't be done at that moment, right? And so I have certain mannerisms, certain tics, certain, you know, idiosyncrasies that I do that don't mean anything other than that's what I do. And then there's some things that I do in situations that are uncomfortable that are just unique to me. And, you know, there is no universal tell. There is no, you know, universal sort of predictor of lying, deception, whatever, just like there isn't for whether someone feels happy or sad. I mean, clearly, smiling is generally an indication of being happy, but you can also smile when you're uncomfortable. You can laugh when you're uncomfortable. And so it's not, oh, he laughed. He thinks my joke is funny. Maybe he laughed because he feels like he has to laugh and he thinks your joke is terrible. But if he were to say it's terrible, then he would ruin the relationship or otherwise, you know, whatever. He's in a situation where he can't or feels like he can't, you know, say that. So yeah, nonverbals are hypotheses. 93% of communication is not always nonverbal. That's a misrepresentation of that original research. I think that's the most harmful myth. And I think all of the other myths of nonverbal communication are probably derived from at least an explicit or an implicit belief in that 93, or even if it's not 93, it's the majority of communication is nonverbal, or putting any kind of number on verbal versus nonverbal communication is just silly.
No, I appreciate all of that. And we should be evaluating the totality of what we're observing in the context of the situation. And even that laughing piece, you know, how many people laugh because they're nervous? When my son was in kindergarten, he got in a little bit of trouble for being with another little boy and playing a game at recess that they shouldn't have been. And when they told him he was in trouble, he laughed because he was nervous. And so now they're telling my wife and I that he was disrespectful because he laughed. Like, well, let's break this down. Like, was he laughing at you or was he laughing to get nervous energy out of his body because he'd never been in this situation before? Like, let's work through this. So sometimes, you know, making those rash judgments, to your point, are far more detrimental than they are helpful. And that line of these behaviors are hypotheses that need to be tested is spectacular.
Yeah, or you laugh because, you know, your kid says something so insightful that you're like, oh my God, that is, most adults would not have thought about that. And they say, why are you laughing at me? He's like, baby, I am not laughing at you. I am laughing because that's the smartest thing I've heard someone say in 3 days. So we laugh because it's just a behavior that feels comfortable for whatever reason in that moment. It could mean a lot of different things. And what I'm intending with my laughter, it is true that nonverbals are likely to be misinterpreted more than verbals. It's also true that if the verbal and nonverbal are not matched with each other, then I'm more likely as a listener to pay attention to the nonverbal than I am to the verbal. But that doesn't necessarily mean the nonverbal is the truth or it's leaking. The truth is leaking out through my nonverbals, which is kind of the Ekman hypothesis that Lie to Me, that TV show, was totally based on that theory that of leakage. That's pretty much been debunked in that literature. But it's all based on that 93% missed statistic.
Sure. Now I had a question I was going to ask based on that and totally vacated my mind. So here we go. I will be the one to cop to that. I'll go to this question instead. Hopefully people are listening to this conversation and reflecting a little bit and thinking, you know, there are some steps that I should be taking and maybe there are some approaches I should be embracing. And, you know, I'm probably a pretty proficient listener in some situations, but not so much in others. And I'll be honest, I find it easier to be a better listener professionally than personally. Professionally, it feels like for me, it's easier to turn it on and be focused because it's my job and what I'm supposed to be doing. And at home, where it's actually more important, sometimes it can be more difficult for me. So for the people that are really looking to start making improvements in their listening, where do you recommend they start?
I think it starts with self-awareness again. What are your primary, what are your strengths? You can do a SWOT analysis specific to listening. What are my strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats? And don't just fill it out for yourself. Ask your business partner or your spouse or your kids to help you, particularly with the weaknesses and the threats. Most of us, are pretty kind to ourselves in terms of our strengths and relatively honest when it comes to strengths. But what weaknesses, we tend to either underreport or misreport those. If you want a more formal assessment, the ECHO is available. Myself or another certified professional. I have a course called Becoming a Professional Listener that people can find on the Listen First Project page, listenfirstproject.org, under the tab called Movement. It's an online course and people can say how much they're willing to pay for it. It's one of those sort of like, honor systems. If you, have a, no income or little income, it's basically free. If you, make a whole bunch of money, we ask that you kind of donate it and all the money goes to Listen First Project, split between them and the hosting organization, which is also a nonprofit organization. You can start with a book, of course, your Disciplined Listening Method book, although I haven't finished it. What I've read so far, one of the reasons I agreed to come on the podcast in the first place is because I think it's a really good resource. So a book like that, if you're more of an academic type, you could start with a Carl Rogers or some other kind of, academic book. But start somewhere, whether it's my work or Avi Kluger's work or your book, becoming a professional listening course, or, going to one of the dialogue and deliberation organizations like Essential Partners or Living Room Conversations and diving into one of those methods, or if you're a healthcare professional, learning motivational interviewing or appreciative inquiry, that's sort of been, modified and particularly tailored for the healthcare context. Start somewhere other than Googling what is a good listener and printing off the top 10 tips from Forbes. There are better resources than that out there. And there's in addition to your book, there's a couple other. Kate Murphy has a good book. Doesn't really give a lot of practical tips, but it does overview some of the reasons that we aren't very good listeners in the workplace context. There's a book by Bernard Ferrari called he's the author. It's basically a book on strategic listening. There's another one by Laurie Lewis called Strategic Organizational Listening, something like that, I think, which is good for the organizational context. There's a lot of good material out there, and there's also a lot of stuff out there that is more myth than fact. So for what it's worth, people that listen to this podcast are probably able to vet that out. And I've given you a couple of examples of some work, both my own work and work of others, that would be good starting places.
I appreciate that. And I'll include links to the books that you mentioned as well and check a few of them out myself for sure. And I found your work to be very influential for me as I was putting the book together and really looking to make sure that I had that literature piece, the academic piece, the research piece in line. And that, in fact, reading your four goal-oriented listening styles put a delay in me writing my book as I was looking at starting to take different directions to make sure that I was accounting for the right thing. So I think that's very important for people to educate themselves on should they have the time and the interest.
Awesome. I appreciate that.
So while we're on that topic, you mentioned the Listen First Project. For people who are listening to this conversation and thinking, I need more. I need more of this expertise. I need more of these resources. Where can they go to connect with you, to learn from you, to engage with you?
Yeah, so my website, grahambodie.com or listenfirstproject.org. So Listen First Project is particularly in the domain of conversations over usually political, but capital P and lowercase p political disagreements, kind of like, why can't we all quote unquote get along? Why are we so uncivil at this moment in U.S. history? And so it is attempting to bring you know, a focus of listening to others, particularly those with whom we disagree, in more nuanced ways, not necessarily to agree or to all vote for the same person, but to understand that voting for different people isn't born out of, you know, complete and utter stupidity, that people can vote for the other guy or girl, out of, you know, just having a different set of values that they, appreciate. And that organization is, a what's called a backbone organization for a larger coalition of over 500 organizations that do that work. And I mentioned two that I really appreciate, in Essential Partners, that does a lot of deep community-based local work, and Living Room Conversations, that offers over 100 guides to have difficult listen first kinds of conversations with six people that you might know very well in your community, but that you might not have ever had the ability or, you know, the courage to get together. We have an event coming up in April called National Week of Conversation that I believe runs April 15th through the 21st or 22nd, whatever that week is. And those are opportunities to try out some of these. And that website is conversation.us. Conversation.us will provide more information about how people can get involved, whether they want to host their own event or whether they want to join an event either in their community or online that allows them to maybe practice some of the listening skills they've been trying to hone. Maybe they've got a New Year's resolution of some sort to be a better communicator, better listener, better parent, better human, through the power of listening more deeply to other people. And they can practice that during National Week of Conversation in April.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I'll make sure to include all of those links in the show notes so people don't have to go hunting for them. They can just find them.
Perfect.
I really appreciate you taking the time today to share your expertise, share your insight, talk a little bit more about the literature and the research and what's important to know, apply, and understand. So I'm very grateful for you taking the time to have the conversation so we can share with our audience today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Now, my pleasure. I look forward to hopefully keeping in touch. Please take care, be safe, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Perfect. Thank you.
Graham, thank you for a fantastic and very educational conversation. I sincerely appreciate it. And again, I hope everybody listening took as many notes as I did during that conversation. Just the simple concept of let the story be told is so powerful. The 5% rule, at least 5% of what somebody says, no matter how crazy, is probably going to be valuable. I love that. Continuing to increase our focus on our own self-awareness as listeners and communicators. Even understanding that when we make these nonverbal observations, in many ways, these are hypotheses that need to be tested. So many great concepts and ideas, so many teachable moments. Graham, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation today. I truly appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who stayed throughout the conversation and listened to it. I appreciate it. And again, I hope you took so much away from this conversation. Thank you very much. And thank you to our sponsors. Before we leave, HumanTel. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off all of their online self-paced training. Understand what people are likely thinking and feeling by accurately evaluating their facial expressions and body language for signs of emotions, and then use that intelligence to build better connections, better rapport, show better empathy. Humantel.com, the code's INQUASIVE25. Head over to certifiedinterviewer.com for the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can see all of their educational opportunities, all of their member benefits and opportunities, and it's where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Do you qualify? What's it take to pass and maintain the designation? Certifiedinterviewer.com and INQUASIVE. Please head over to INQUASIVE.com to learn more about the customized education sessions that we provide for our clients when they ask us to come teach their leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and beyond the observation skills and the persuasive communication skills necessary to drive better relationships and stronger outcomes by encouraging people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. If you're enjoying these conversations about listening and communication and you'd like to learn more, please check out the book, The Disciplined Listening Method. You can find a copy at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. Once again, I appreciate everybody for taking the time to be here. Thank you. Before you go, please take a second, like the show. If you haven't already subscribed to the show, share it, leave your feedback. We love to hear your thoughts so we can integrate more of what you would like to see and what you would like to hear. Thank you all again. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.